This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, I am very excited to have an extraordinary guest, someone who is in the process of changing the world, very gently and but very firmly, and with great determination. Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell is the discoverer, really, of the fact that unvoiced people and people on the autism spectrum are often fluently telepathic. Dr. Powell has been in clinical service for many, many years, certainly back all the way back into the 1990s, and has provided her services to very many people. We're going to talk about that. And we're also going to talk about what she knows about telepathy and how it might fit in even to the broader world. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell to Dreamland. Welcome, Diana. I'm very glad you're here.
Thank you.
Good. Well, at some point in your life, you discovered that unvoiced people on the autism spectrum were telepathic. When did that happen?
Back in 2011, 2012, that area of time, when I went to India to evaluate these savants because I was interested in savant syndrome. And I was invited over there to evaluate several children and to also give a day-long workshop based on my book, The ESP Enigma. And when I was over there testing savant skills, one of the parents said to me that their child was telepathic, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then another person said to me, well, all of these children are telepathic. And I said, really, that's very interesting. I said, well, if that's the case, then when I'm testing them for savant syndrome, that would be a problem, because if I'm testing to see if they're a mathematical savant and can give me the cube root of a six-digit number, almost instantaneously without deriving it because they can't do arithmetic, well, telepathy would be one way in which they could be getting the answer. So it was after that that I put out the hypothesis that these children could be telepathic. And it was after that I started hearing from families around the world who said, yes, you're right. I've been living with this for a period of time and I didn't know what to do with it. And I'm happy to see that somebody's actually taking it seriously and studying it.
Now, that could not have been an entirely acceptable thing to bring into the public space, given your scientific background. There must have been quite a bit of pushback from your colleagues.
I didn't bring it into... So after the medical board did what they did to me because I wrote a book on ESP, and it's not a book in which I claim that... I hadn't claimed that I... It's not about my own research. I'm not claiming that I proved ESP in the book. I'm not claiming that I have ESP. All I'm saying is that our models within physics would allow for this, because we realize at a quantum level that reality is very strange. And I knew that our model for neuroscience was so incomplete that it couldn't even explain basic things like what is consciousness. And so that combination made me look into the literature in parapsychology, where people have done experiments on things like telepathy. And I saw that there was a lot of people who were really credible, distinguished scientists over the past 100 years or so who had looked into these things and felt that there was something there. So that combination of those things said to me, as a scientist, I'm not going to dismiss these phenomena. And so that was what my book was about. And after I saw how the medical board regarded that, because in my profession, we're trained that somebody is mentally ill if they say that they have these abilities. And so that's really the standard by which people determine whether you're in reality or not. And then you get put on an antipsychotic if you're not. And so to have a psychiatrist saying that they thought that some of these things were possible, that's really problematic. And so I really laid kind of low in terms of my research over the last 12 years or so because of that. And I needed to make an income as a medical doctor. But I would research these cases and then present what I had to fellow scientists at, like a parapsychological association meeting and also at the science of consciousness meeting. And so I was wanting to, to show it to other scientists and just keep it at that level of discussion. I wasn't going public and making any kind of announcements. And it wasn't until I met Kai and she observed some of my experiments that she thought this really needs to go public in a big way.
And is that when you began to get into trouble? I very well remember. I knew Dr. John Mack, of course, who studied close encounter witnesses. He was at Harvard at the time, head of their department of psychiatry. And he ended up in a situation where he had his tenure challenged and his license to practice challenged. And he called me up one morning and said, they're trying to ruin my life. He was ambushed in a meeting with his superiors, or with his dean, rather, I forgot exactly what the title of the dean was, and a number of other people, and was just absolutely gobsmacked by what happened to him. Did anything similar happen to you, if I may ask?
Well, so let me make sure that you understand the sequence of events, because the issues I had with my medical board were back in 2010, and my book was published in December of 2008. And so it was after I had been given, I was basically on a book tour, and so more and more people were becoming aware of my book. And then that's when the board called me in and had me evaluated, and I had to prove that I didn't have a mental illness. That and so I got my license back. But so I practiced for the next 12 years and retired from medicine, knowing that the telepathy tapes, we were expecting a documentary to come out first, but knowing that there was, my research was going to become more public. And so I retired from the practice of medicine. And so I'm not, in trouble with anybody. I mean, as far as I know, all I'm doing is I'm researching a phenomenon that is getting reported by countless parents who are all experiencing this. And somebody's got to figure out what's going on here. Somebody's got to do the experiments. And because of the fact that I've been in this field for so long, it makes sense for me to be the one who does the experiments.
Well, exactly. It certainly does. You're so very knowledgeable, and you have, I understand the conventional neuroscience community. It doesn't accept the idea that there is any possible emanation from the brain or into it from the outside, except through the known senses. And you're dealing with something that is not a known sense. It's obviously there. It's a sense. Your research, in my opinion, and I'm not a scientist, but I'm not stupid either. It's pretty conclusive. And so something does happen. There is a connection. Can you talk to a little bit to what you think it might be now? What do you think might be happening between the unvoiced people and their caregivers and loved ones?
What do you mean, like, what do I think is the mechanism behind it? Is that what you're asking?
I know you certainly can't come to a final conclusion now, but you must be working in that direction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. So just to be clear, so what I have observed is I have observed children who, there are many children who can have their parent, or sometimes it's their teacher or their speech therapist, be thinking of a word or thinking of a random digit, and then having the intention of sending it to the child, and then the child will point out on a letter or a number board what it is that the person's thinking. And the majority of the people who report this phenomenon to me, that's the case. That's their means of communicating. And I've always known that would be very controversial, because you don't have enough of a distance between the person who knows the thing that's being transmitted and the person who's receiving it. I mean, they're right next to them with the letter board. And I always knew that would be problematic. And so I've focused predominantly on trying to find cases in which a child has advanced beyond that communication method onto typing individually into an iPad, or, you know, something called a talker, or even speaking occasionally. And so I've seen a couple of children who can type independently into a talker, and you get the same profound high accuracy. I mean, we're talking like 97% for random numbers. And I've also seen a child who could speak it. And I couldn't get, he was very young and energetic, and I couldn't get him to participate in the experiments more than just to do, say 2-3 digit numbers. But he still, he was very accurate. Actually, I did a 4-digit number with him. And so that's the basis. That's the basis of my thinking, that there really could be a there. But what needs to happen is that we really need to make sure that there's no cueing going on, because that's what the skeptics are saying. I understand why they're saying it. Doesn't mean that's what's happening, but we're working towards getting the conditions in which we can have them in, for example, separate rooms. Whatever we can to eliminate any kind of visual or auditory cueing. And it takes spending time with them, spending time with the parents to get them towards that, being able to do that, because these children are so they're so routine oriented. They need things to be done the same way over and over again. I mean, that's one of the things about somebody who's autistic. That's one of the diagnostic criteria, is that they're very repetitious. They don't like much change from what they're used to, and they're amazing pattern recognizers, and I think it's that combination of things that's involved in this process. But I think ultimately, if we're able to establish that they can do this at a distance, then the ramifications for what consciousness is and its relationship to the body and the brain are profound. It really would firmly take us out of the materialist model and say that consciousness does not reside within the skull. And in fact, I think that a better way of thinking about consciousness is that consciousness is actually something that the brain decodes, that we basically are surrounded by information that can come from different sources, and that our brain is actually decoding that information. But that some people get caught up in these psychological tapes where the information that they're dealing with is never outside of their own sort of repetitive thought process. I mean, people have looked at how much time does somebody spend having a novel thought versus having a repetitive thought? And the vast majority of people, if they really analyze it, take the time to sit back and look at their thought patterns, will say that, gosh, yeah, I have these thoughts on a regular basis. It's the same thing I say to myself.
Yeah, we're going to take a brief break, And when we get back, we'll be talking more and getting a little deeper into issues such as whether or not you can become telepathic. Is it possible to learn this? Dr. Powell's website is drdianehennessy.com. You can see it on the crawl below me. So visit Dr. Diane at drdianehennessy.com. It's a wonderful site, and it is full of information. And in particular, if you have an unvoiced person on the autism spectrum in your life, you might very well want to get into touch with Dr. Powell with the hope of enriching your family life experience. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. Dr. Powell is a pioneer, discoverer of the fact that unvoiced people on the autism spectrum are sometimes, but not always, telepathic. Now, Dr. Diane, when I had Kai Dickens, who created the telepathy tapes and is your fellow angel in this revolution, she wanted to text one of the spellers during the show in order to get a piece of information that she didn't have that I had asked a question about. And when the text came back from the speller, and this all happened right on the show, not only did he answer the question, he also talked about what we were talking about on the show. But since the show is a recording, it's not possible. He couldn't have known anything about what we were talking about, but his response was quite extraordinary. Now, and so I want to start by asking you, are some of the spellers able to, obviously some of them are able to read at distance, and perhaps he wasn't even aware that he was doing it. But what are the parameters, the dimensions of this as we understand it now?
These children have so many different abilities that really are all kind of fall into that category of non-local consciousness. So what they report is they things like being able to see at a distance, clairvoyance or remote viewing, depending upon what term you like for that, or seeing into the future. And a lot of them will report these precognitive visions that they have. And some of them report that they remember what it was like between lives or even remember a past life. Some of them, I'd say many of them, not only report seeing spirits, but they have done spontaneous mediumship readings when they were with somebody, such as a family member or a teacher that they were working with. They'd suddenly say, oh, there's someone, in the corner of the room who says his name is Joe, and he was your grandfather, and this is what he has to say. And it's like, gosh, I had a grandfather named Joe. How did you know that? And so that kind of thing happens. And so a lot of these, one of the problems in terms of moving the needle in science is that these are really fascinating. They all are sort of, I think, saying the same thing, that really our idea of consciousness is incorrect, that there is a non-local consciousness that we can all tap into. That's what I think is probably going to end up being the consensus once the research is done. But some of these things that are reported, we're going to formally test them. In other words, it's been reported that these children that they're telepathic with one another. And so that's something that we're already starting to do, is to have them, the two children, in separate rooms and asking them to demonstrate conversation between themselves or send numbers to one another. So, and then there's protocols for studying mediumship, et cetera. So I see that there's a lot of different studies that could come out of this, because it does look like what is happening is more than telepathy, that there's something much larger than that that's going on.
Well, I had an experience. Once I realized that this was possible. I began to, and I've had a lot of life experiences prior to this that were telepathic, and because I'm a close encounter witness, as I'm sure you know, and anyone in this area is going to have telepathic experiences, which have been going on all of my life. It's not something I can consciously initiate, but it's something I'm fairly familiar with the experience of. And I was in Mexico last week and standing on a crowded street corner, and there was a, I assume, a non-speaker in front of me with her mother, and she looked about in her early teens, and we're getting ready to cross the street. And suddenly I became aware of this non-speaker in a different way. I can't really put into words what I mean. And she immediately turned around and smiled at me. And I thought, my goodness, she's telepathically connecting to me. And so the next thing I knew, she seemed a little uneasy. And so I tried to communicate the idea that I was, you know, that there was nothing to worry about, essentially. And there was an attempt to make verbal contact, word level contact, but I didn't speak Spanish and she didn't speak English. And this then happened. Suddenly I saw an image of a dog in my head, and a quite vivid image of a little dog. And the dog looked very much like the dog I had as a child. And then I saw an image of my dog with the other dog. And I realized that what she's done is she showed me her dog and compared it to my dog, which is only in my memory. And I thought, what in the world is actually going on here? Then she and her mother both turned around and smiled at me, and the light changed and they went off across the street. Now, this implies the presence of an enormous level of consciousness that we are just barely beginning to touch. How does that comport with what you are discovering?
Your story, how does that fit with it? Or
level of the what I'm trying to communicate is that there is that this isn't just the trading of words between people without talking. There's something much bigger here, because I thought it was just an extraordinary experience, and it was huge because it implies that she could go into my mind and find the image of my dog, compare it to her dog, show me her dog, and then my dog side by side as a way of communicating with me.
I think that a better term than telepathy, and this was a term that one of the mothers of one of these children, so the mother of Akhil, Manisha, said, is that she preferred that we use the word shared consciousness. And I think that that probably is a more accurate way of thinking about it. And so that implies that more can be transmitted, for lack of a better word, from one individual to another, because it can be transmitting information that you're not really consciously thinking about. I mean, that could be what the mediumship is entirely. It could be that the kid's just tapping into that, that unconscious material that's there. And so this idea of shared consciousness is, I think, one of the most compelling stories I've heard that makes me think that is this mother of an autistic girl who told me that her daughter goes through the archives in her consciousness. I mean, she says that she physically or feels it, like, and her daughter's going through the archives trying to find something within her mother's consciousness, and knows all kinds of things that she wasn't even thinking about. So it's exactly what you're talking about. And
yes, exactly. It sure is. Mm-hmm. Well, I find that absolutely fascinating. Because it implies, excuse me, it implies that this level of consciousness is huge, and that we're all kind of almost filtering it in order to live our lives. And perhaps these kids don't filter like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right, that they can't filter these things. And then the question is, why can't they filter them? You know, what is the filter mechanism? And that's what I've been interested in, is not only finding experimental data to show that these phenomena could be real, but it's also to then take those once you've established a baseline for that, then see how does it change as you change the conditions. In other words, is it something that drops off if they're further apart from one another? Would shared consciousness require some kind of overlap of your consciousness field? I mean, people talk about us having a consciousness field, which, you know, it varies in sort of the degree to which it extends outside of our body. But let's say, you know, that it extends out of our body for 5 feet or 20 feet. Okay. Is it necessary to be within that consciousness field to have that overlap between the two for the sharing to occur?
That, of course, is an excellent question. A friend of mine, a broadcaster called Ross Coulthart, recently had a special forces operator on his show called Jake Barber. I don't know if you are aware of this or not. Are you aware of this at all?
Well, yes. I mean, let me say that I've never met Jake Barber, and I had never even heard of him until that interview came out. But I've heard that he's publicly said that I'm on his team. And
I haven't heard that.
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a minute. that wasn't the direction I was going in. But,
I thought I'd better qualify it, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the way that I would, the way that I think is the accurate way to put it is that there's a parent company that it has a desire to do what Skywatcher is doing. And I'm not 100% sure what all Skywatcher is doing. I can't ask you that
question because I've never heard of it myself.
So. Yeah, I've never heard of it. I don't know what they're doing. What I know I'm doing is that I have been asked as a neuropsychiatrist who understands parapsychology as well. I'm on the board for the third time of the Parapsychological Association to study people that have extraordinary psi abilities. And so one of those individuals might be Jake Barber, because I mean, if he has a number of people, it sounds like he might, who said, yes, he has indeed been successful at doing what he does, then it's one of those opportunities to try to see, well, what's different about him? Why is it he's able to do this, which to most of us just sounds so extraordinary. It seems like it's impossible what he's saying he's doing. And so I'm part of a team of people studying the sort of neuropsychiatry behind some of the extraordinary abilities.
Well, in America, our culture is anyone who's even close to a team is on the team. So I can understand why he says you're on his team now. No, that wasn't the direction I was taking the question. I had no idea about any of this. But in any case, what I would like to ask is that he mentions what he calls psionics and operators who are involved in this. And I've heard, well, more than heard, I know a considerable amount about intuitives who engage with what they think of as non-human intelligence, which, as my listeners know, I'm not at all sure what exactly it is. And I've lived with it for most of my life. In any case, I was wondering if you've ever encountered people outside of the autism spectrum who aren't spellers, who are as fluently telepathic as the spellers? Or have you even gone in that direction yet?
Well, I would say that I have fairly regularly received emails from people who are neurodivergent, which I think is a better term to use than autistic, because autism has all of these other things that it attaches on there. So, but we know that their brain processes information differently, and they're capable of communicating by typing into their computer and sending me an email or even speaking to me. Although for them, that form of communication is like breathing through a straw. It's so slow and painstaking because their brains process information in ways that's so rapid that to try to take that gestalt thinking process and then put it into words is hard. If you think about people who have these extraordinary experiences, these spiritual experiences, that they're frequently described as ineffable. And why do they use the term ineffable? It's because it's difficult to describe in terms. And it's difficult to describe in terms because it's something that you're experiencing, and for just to be simplistic, with more right brain dominance than left brain dominance. And so the left brain is the one that's involved in language. The right brain is one that's involved in intuition and gestalt thinking. And so if you're predominantly operating out of that, you know, out of the, you know, that decoding system, let's say, then to take that and to try to code it into something verbal is difficult. But there are people who can do that. And they do have a similar report of various experiences, like the ones who use the letterboards to communicate in terms of spontaneous experiences of seeing spirits or seeing the future or et cetera. So yes, you do not have to be autistic person, and you certainly don't have to be non-speaking in order to have these experiences.
Well, that's a relief because I know quite a few people who aren't or not noticeably neurodivergent who do have these abilities. I have met people who were profoundly neurodivergent and obviously to my eye on the autism spectrum, who weren't in any kind of institutional setting or in classes, or they were older people, and they were very fluent at this. You could easily communicate with them telepathically, and they're just out in the ordinary population. So I've often wondered how many people are like that, and they don't come forward for obvious reasons, but they must be out there, and there must be quite a few. And I wonder, what's your sense of the degree that this actually penetrates the society in a kind of silent way, maybe? Do you have any intuition about that at all?
Well, I mean, one of the things I want to say is that the people who have these really high sensitivities tend to be more reclusive. I was just talking with someone earlier today, and a lot of them can't go out in public. It's extremely uncomfortable. So they're not really integrated. So even though they can speak and they can use their bodies in ways that they could pass and be in public, it's so uncomfortable for them.
It's that agony.
They prefer not to.
I know some that live in little enclaves together. They do not have any support at all. And I've wondered if there would be any way of reaching them, because we do have, after all, people who are in our level of the world, who could give them support and help and all kinds of things. And I'm sure that if they were better known, but they're really very reclusive. And I've approached some of them whom I know a little bit, and they are adamantly opposed to this. They don't want it. And I'm wondering if there would be any, if you've ever considered if there might be any way of somehow breaking that barrier and approaching them, because I think there might be quite a few of them in the world.
What is this that they're opposed to? What is it that they're...
They don't want to have any kind of professional help. They feel that will bring with it all kinds of conditions and possibly levels of notice that they want nothing to do with.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that there's a tremendous lack of trust in the mental health profession because of its long history of pathologizing any of these things.
Precisely.
And that's one of the reasons why so many people reach out to me, I think, is because I'm not here to try to pathologize anybody. I'm here to try to understand, you know, and to try to, you know, because this is their reality.
Yes.
And what I've seen is, you know, that a lot of them, you know, have had the experience of being put on antipsychotics, and it didn't really change some of their reality. I mean, it just slowed them down so that they couldn't really function very well. And so many of them need to be able to connect with one another. So if they feel like they're within their like kind, then they actually can be quite social because it feels safe.
Yes. The people I'm referring to are mostly young adults, and I guess the oldest would be in their 40s and the youngest probably in their teens. And I know of some of them who live out in the desert here in Joshua Tree area. And I tried to connect with a couple who are like that, who are lived together out there. And the husband was fairly open, but the wife, I mean, she might have, if I hadn't gotten out of there, she might have just come after me. She was really not, she was not interested. So I have to ask you this. If such a person were to get in touch with you, what would be your response, and what level of privacy could they count on?
Oh, I mean, I practice as a psychiatrist for over 40 years. I mean, I operate on confidentiality. That to me is, I don't announce who people are unless I have their permission. I mean, and so over the years, most of the people who contacted me about their autistic kid, this is all pre-telepathy tapes. They didn't want to be become famous. They just contacted me because they wanted to know, you know, what to do. They wanted to understand what was going on. And some of the kids I think that showed the most promise in terms of demonstrating it, there's no way the parents would want them to be involved in a documentary.
None of these people are going to get anywhere near a documentary.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in two types of research. I mean, and what I mean by two types, it's the type of research in which the person is willing to have somebody who's a documentarian filming them, and those who just want to stay private, and but they want to contribute to science. And so I see those as two different populations. And I don't have the resources to help everybody who reaches out to me. I barely have the time to answer all the emails that I get. And so it really speaks to a need that is out there. A big need, an enormous need that is out there to have something that is an alternative to just, you know, drugging these people up. And because, I mean, they're not a danger to anybody.
No, not at all. We need to take another break, Diane. I've gotten, and this happens every show, all my listeners love it. I forget about the breaks because I get so interested in the show. Anyway, this is break time. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. Her website, Dr. Diane Hennessy. Let me turn the ticker on. DrDianeHennessy.com. You can visit her there and engage with her there. And if you should be one of the people that we are talking about, have been talking about, you know who you are, and I know some of you watch the show. You can get into contact with Diane there. And if they do get into contact with you, Diane, I don't expect to hear about it, obviously. And I would ask you if you could tell me what would be your immediate response if you get, perhaps it would be an email from someone who says, I'm familiar with what Whitley was talking about, and I'm interested in talking to you because of whatever reason they may give.
Well, what I need, because I, as I said, I'm getting a lot of emails. So what I would need is for them to really describe who they are and what it is that they, who they are, what they've experienced, and, you know, what they hope to get out of being in contact with me, so that I can think about, you know, how I could either help them or research, you know, what it is that they're describing, just so that I know where to put them, what category to put them in, and what would be the appropriate way to respond. And then there are some people that I do set up a Zoom call with afterwards, just so that I can get a sense more of who they are. It depends. Right now, I mean, we're really under a crunch to try to get the film made. Kai's under a lot of deadlines for that, and so I'm particularly interested in people who think that they can demonstrate telepathy with the kind of separation that we would like, and people who are interested in having any kind of free assessment of their brain waves, for example, what's the brain waves of the child doing at the time that they're experiencing this shared consciousness, let's say, with the other individual. I mean, do we see a synchronization, for example, of their brain waves? So there's some people that might want to engage in that research, but they don't want to be filmed for a documentary, and that's fine. So that's my highest priority right now. But I do see that I do see things shifting, so that we're also going to be able to research people that have these abilities that don't fall within the parameters for the film.
Well, these people I'm talking about are mostly, in terms of the socially, they're semi-functional, and they tend to be very poor, and they live in generally in really, really very poor surroundings. They're often ill-fed, and they often have diseases, and a lot of them are like schizophrenics. They smoke all the time. And do you know anything about why that is? I've studied that pretty extensively because I think it's obvious. I'm not telling you a lot about, I don't want to say a lot about these people that because they're so sensitive, but they're struggling and they're really in trouble. And, what I read was that nicotine, in the case of schizophrenia, when a person has voices in their head, the nicotine smooths, it doesn't stop the voices, but it lessens the intensity of the experience. These people have such voices in their heads, but they're the voices of the normal normal people around them. And that's why a lot of them live out in the desert, because they're farther away from most people and they don't have so much noise in their heads. Can you speak to that use of tobacco as a tranquilizer? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, I when I was doing inpatient psychiatry, it was at a time when they still allowed smoking in hospitals, and particularly they allowed smoking in the psych ward. So it seemed like there was practically everybody smoked.
Yes.
And in terms of the neuropharmacology of it, nicotine works on the acetylcholine receptors. And the acetylcholine receptors are in opposition to dopamine receptors. And if you look at a lot of the antipsychotics that are used for treating schizophrenia, they're dampening down dopamine activity. So what the cigarettes are doing is that it's like a self-medication that's kind of reducing some of that hyperdopaminergic state without it being something that sort of slows them down the way an antipsychotic does. Because unfortunately, these antipsychotics also work on other dopamine centers in the brain, you know, like the basal ganglia, and it causes a lot of difficulties with moving their bodies, for example.
Yes, I'm familiar with that. I would, anyway, that's helpful to know, because I think that it's a major health issue for these people, because of, you know, obviously smoking's not healthy for you. Some of them have wanted, it's interesting, they wanted me to smoke, because they said it would make it easier for them to communicate with me telepathically. Have you ever heard anything like that before?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard that. Makes me wonder if they're still talking about cigarettes here.
They wanted me to vape, actually, because it was obvious I wouldn't smoke cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And I won't do that either. So they're important to me in my life. And I want to help them, and there's very little I can say about them. They're extremely sensitive. And so I'm going to go on now to other aspects of this conversation. And I would like to ask you now about your book and what was in it, because, of course, and also if there's any place people can get it. I know they can't get it on Amazon right now.
No, they can't. They can get a signed copy from me through my website. So they can order it there. And then there's an audio book of it available on Amazon. And I'm trying to get the ebook back on there. And what's in the book? I mean, it's really written in a very scholarly way. I mean, it was reviewed favorably by my medical school, and it also is in libraries across the U.S. And so what was in it was that I basically said what I said earlier, is that I talked about the model in neuroscience and why it's incomplete and why we can't exclude ESP as a possibility based on that. Then I talked about basically physics from over a century ago that shows us that our reality that we perceive is really different from what our senses tell us is reality is different from what physics is telling us. For example, that our perception of time as an arrow that only moves in one direction, moves forward, is incorrect. I mean, Einstein said our sense of time is an illusion. And so I talk about things like that. And then I also talk about about the research that has been done by other scientists, such as the scientists at Stanford Research Institute, showing that different types of psychic abilities have been demonstrated to a significant level using statistical analysis. But there's also qualitative analysis as well. And so I go through each one of the different phenomena with the parapsychology studies and talk about some of the evidence for it. And then I talk about who it is that seems to report these experiences the most, and how their brain activity, based on what I know as a psychiatrist, the brain activity is more similar to the brain activity of somebody in dreaming sleep. And
brain activity.
And that's one of the reasons why I hypothesize that autistic children, particularly ones who get designated as savants, would be the most likely to demonstrate psychic abilities, because they're, if you look at savant skills, they're very right hemisphere oriented, and they have left hemisphere deficits. And when we're in dreaming sleep, our right hemisphere is what's dominant, and our left hemisphere shuts down. And so so those are the kinds of things that I talk about in the book.
Wow, I've got to read it. And folks, I urge you to go to drdianehennessy.com and get a copy. I think we all need to read it or listen to the Audible. I know a lot of people nowadays listen to audiobooks, because when I publish a book, the first thing everyone says is, where's the audiobook? And in incidentally, those of you who are interested in my new book, the audiobook should be out in about 2 weeks. My book is on Amazon. And in any case, hopefully your book will be back on Amazon soon. But get it now, folks, because I'm sure it's extremely empowering. And this is important, because we live in a culture that is constantly telling us something about ourselves that's not true, that we are confined to this is all we are. But we're not. We're much more. We're much more. And Diane knows it. And Diane, do you have any telepathic contact with any of the spellers that you work with? I know some of their caregivers do.
Oh, that's an interesting question. But I haven't had an opportunity to spend as much time with them. But I will say that I can read people pretty well, and there have been times when I've said something and I see them light up afterwards. They're like, yeah, you're right, you know. And so but I don't know what I'd label that, but I just have I get these intuitive insights. And that's something that I did as a psychotherapist with people. I would get this intuitive insight and I would tell them what it was that I thought, and they're like, wow, you know. And so I've had people say that they think that I read minds, but I don't know that I'd go out there and say that I do.
Yeah, I know the feeling, that kind of intuition. I've always, well, my father was telepathic, frankly. He had to have been. He and his brother were involved with the government all of their lives. And his brother was an air materiel and worked on the Roswell incident at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, and then with the Atomic Energy Commission when that project was moved to the Atomic Energy Commission. And so it's been in my life, and I think that there are people in the outside world who are not, who my father was normally voiced, but he certainly had noticeable and quite obvious telepathic skills, to my great horror when I was a little boy. In any case, but he was quite kind about it. I think we've reached the end of our free part of the show, and if you could go on with us for a little bit longer, there are a few other questions that I think I would very much like to ask about whether or not and how people who are interested in this and would like to become telepathic themselves, if there's any avenue they could, any way that you any suggestions you have. So the free part of the show will end now, and in a moment we will continue on for our subscribers. So Diane, let me know, is there any way, say there's a person listening to this or watching this and they think to themselves, I wonder if I have any of these abilities, or if I don't, could I develop them? Have you gone in that direction at all? Explored in that direction at all, I should say.
Well, I think that people can be trained to do these things. I mean, there were training programs within the military, for example. There are training programs. And so the fact that there were training programs within the military suggests that they're trainable. That's the only reason why I bring that up. there are pockets all over the world where you have these people that are training children and even adults to do something called MindSight, which is a very similar phenomenon in that with MindSight, you're wearing a blindfold where it's really a dense blindfold so that you can't see anything. And they train you to be able to see what's in front of you or to read despite wearing the blindfold. So it's training you to basically use your third eye for sight. And there's also meditation programs where people learn to focus. A lot of what meditation's about is not just relaxing. It's about gaining mastery over your mind and where you put your attention. And the better you can put your attention on something specific, and the more control you have over it, the more you can kind of use these intuitive abilities to hone in on whatever the information is that you want. And basically get rid of the noise that is sort of like the static that and really just focus on the signal. And so there's somebody who's an educator who has been working. He's Irish, but he lives in Mongolia, of all places. He married a Mongolian physician, and he wants to develop an online course with me. This is what we've been talking about, in which we teach people how to develop these skills. And he went from somebody who didn't really, he believed in these things, but didn't, you know, he just would have the odd, you know, time here and there where he'd experience something, to now he can reliably be, you know, fairly accurate on a higher percentage. I mean, he's not like these autistic kids, but he is somebody who can reliably have some accuracy within about, I don't know, I'm guessing when I say 80%. And so he and I have been talking about putting together an online course that would enable people to do this.
That's very interesting. I have a feeling that if you had any financial problems, if you put that course together, those will go away, because a lot of people are going to want to do that. That'd be the first thing I would sign up for personally, because I'm close enough to this to know it is possible for people on the outside of the neurodivergent community to do it. And I've done enough of it and seen it enough of it. And it's interesting that Jake Barber mentions that the U.S. intelligence community is actively working with people outside of the United States. And that must be, he must be referring to the MindSight thing. And what's so odd about it is, why not inside the United States? Because he does specifically say outside of the United States. And I thought to myself, it could be that it's a CIA project, in which case they wouldn't be allowed to do it inside the United States. It would have to be outside. And
I don't. I have no idea. Okay, let me just say I have no idea about what he was referring to there. But what I would say, though, is that you do have cultures, like, for example, the dominant culture in India.
Yes.
Where the culture is so, it's so not only accepting of these phenomena, it's part of their spiritual tradition. They call them siddhis. And yes. So you have people that you don't have to remove all of the obstacles of disbelief.
Yes.
And so it really could be that it's working with civilians. I mean, we have a lot of Indians that come over here to do IT, so that it could be that kind of a resource. I wouldn't necessarily jump to conclusions that it's something CIA oriented, but I really don't, I'm not privy to that kind of information.
In some ways I hope not, because I'm sure this will certainly enter that world very quickly, and probably already has. But something that Kai said struck me very strongly, both in the telepathy tapes and in the interview that she did with me, which is that the spellers say that to do this successfully, you have to be kind and you can't lie and you can't be a liar. And that resonated very much with me. And I thought to myself then, when I heard Jake Barber mentioning it, that I don't see how someone who is doing that kind of work in a government context could really not lie. And I don't see them as being particularly kind, to say the least. So I wonder if they can succeed.
Well, that's a good question. I think that there's this, I think that there's a frequency. Now, this is me getting out on a speculative limb here, but it's okay to speculate as a scientist, as long as you say that you're speculating. And I think that there could be a frequency associated with each of the different emotions, and that love might put us into that frequency, which is the most in harmony with, the collective good, you know, with collective consciousness, you know, that's what's in harmony with it. And so how we attract things is not necessarily like attracting them the way a magnet will attract an iron filing, but we can also attract things by just being in harmony with them.
I think that's a big part of it. I really do. This level of consciousness, when you touch it, it seems quite beautiful. I don't know why I keep bringing up Jake, but he did express himself in this area in very complex and subtle ways during the course of his interview, which surprised me. But one of the things he said that was that something had come out of an object that he was retrieving, and that it was an incredibly sweet presence that had possessed him and was still inside him. I know a considerable amount about these materials, having grown up in that world. And I said years ago to Jacques Vallée and Diane Pasulka and Gary Nolan, who were beginning to work with them, be aware of the fact that when you look at these materials, they're looking back at you. And Jake found that out for sure. So there seems to me to be something here that is incredibly beautiful, that is present in the way the speakers relate to it. And I'm kind of fumbling around here with an effort to see if you felt the same thing, and if you feel this consciousness as a presence somehow in your life, it's perhaps guiding you.
There's something guiding me. there's something guiding me. I mean, there's been way too many synchronicities that have played a role in my being in this position where I'm doing this work that make me think that there is some greater intelligence out there. Because, I mean, it's, you know, that saying, life's what happens when you made other plans. I mean, that describes my life.
And a wonderful quote from Anne Lamott: if you want to make God laugh, tell her your plans.
Right.
So, and it also seems to me that it works best when it's joyous. Like on this street corner that in Mexico that happened to me, that I talked about earlier, was such a joyous moment. We were having fun, and her mother was participating in it too. She was turning around and smiling at me too. We had such a nice time together, the three of us, for just those few minutes. And I thought to myself, what if the whole world lived like this all the time? And then I thought, wouldn't people be afraid to be that open And I thought then, of course, the speakers say, the spellers say, you mustn't be a liar, because, of course, then you have things to hide. How do we learn to live without things to hide? Because I think this consciousness is going to open up to us if we can do that.
Oh, you know, having been a professional psychotherapist for decades, what I would say is that the people who lie and have to hold those lies pay a huge price. So I don't see it as a loss. Oftentimes when the secret comes out, there's a sense of relief. People came to me as a therapist telling me their darkest secrets. Because people told me things that they'd never told their husband or wife of 40 years. And there's a price we pay when we don't tell the truth. But what we need is a society that evolves its consciousness enough that we can handle the truth and transcend whatever it was that led to that aspect of life becoming secret in the first place. I mean, you know, so this is a call on, you know, the evolution of humanity. And I think that people tend to cling on to the familiar. And people, to me, it reminds me of a little child, you know, how, you know, there's an age during development when a little child, you can be standing there in the room, seeing them with their hand in the cookie jar, and they're eating the cookie. And there's an age when they'll say, "No, well, you know, what are you doing eating the cookie, Johnny?" And they'll say, "Oh, I'm not eating the cookie, you know," or "Oh, I didn't take it out of the jar, you know." And it's like, so it's comical. You have to laugh. Because that's the first instinct is, you know, I don't want to get in trouble, so I'm not going to tell you what I did. And it's just like, no, it's okay, you know, it's okay, you know, but you need to not eat cookies before dinner, and if you need to ask me if you want one. And so that's what we need is as society evolves to be more compassionate, loving, and understanding, then it sort of melts away or erodes some of those kinds of concerns about that. And that's really where I hope things to happen, you know. And it's going to, you know, these things happen in layers typically, and not, you know, not overnight. But I think that once things hit a certain momentum, then they take off.
Yeah, they're a critical mass effect. And, you know, I think that we can conclude our conversation with a thought that goes way back to the time of the Roman Empire, when Jesus said to be as little children. And that innocence is perhaps the direction we need to go in to recover our true selves. And Diane, it has been a beautiful experience talking to you. You have a wonderful gestalt about you, a wonderful sense of presence. And I can well see why you have had all of these synchronicities that have brought you to where you are. You belong there. And thank you for all that you do.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, those of you who can stay, I'll do a little meditation now after Diane go, because she's got a life to live. And my listeners sometimes like to do meditations, and so we'll do a little meditation. Thank you very much, Diane, for being with us. And you can just I'll drop you out of the studio now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now it's just us. I hope you had as good a time with this as I did. She's just like Kai Dickens, there's something profoundly sacred about that very straightforward and wonderful woman, and her brilliance really sparkled too, and her open-mindedness. Now, I do this meditation, you know, every day, four times a day, twice during the day and twice at night. So let's just do it together for a few moments, and you can take it with you and do it whenever you have a chance, and make a time. I usually do it at the end of the day, like at 11 o'clock at night when I'm getting ready to go to bed. And then, as most of you know, the visitors used to wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do it every night for many years. And they've, about within the last 6 months or so, they stopped waking me up. But if I don't do it, then they get feisty and they start coming and waking me up again. So I'm supposed to do it on my own now and be responsible for myself. Let's do this. Dr. Powell mentioned the attention briefly and moving the attention. So let's do this. Let's move our attention. And we're a remarkable species in one respect. We can control our own attention. It doesn't always have to go out into the world around us. So if you'll close your eyes with me, now we're going to move our attention to our bodies. Our bodies are always glad to have this. It feels very good suddenly. I feel the presence of my body. Now I move my attention. I concentrate it on my left foot. I move it up to my left lower leg, my upper leg. Now I concentrate on my whole left leg. Now I move up to my left hand and forearm, my left elbow and upper arm, my whole left arm, and my left leg. So I'm concentrating my attention on just my left arm and left leg. Now I leave them and I move to the right, to my right foot, lower leg, knee, and upper leg. I have my attention now on my whole right leg. Leave my leg and move to my arm. I concentrate on my right hand, forearm, and upper arm, and my whole right arm. Now I expand my attention to include both arms and both legs. So I'm concentrating my attention just on my arms and legs. And note how this feels. It's as if your arms and legs are somehow more sensitive right now. Now I leave them and I go to the base of my body. And I go up my spine, up my lower back, middle back, and upper back and shoulders. Now I concentrate my attention on the nape of my neck, my lower scalp, my middle scalp and ears, my upper scalp and the crown of my head. Now also my forehead. I can feel my third eye open. If I concentrate on it, I'll feel a sensation in my forehead just above my eyes in the middle. And if I don't feel that, just point your finger toward it, and you might feel it before you touch your forehead, and otherwise just touch it lightly, and then you'll feel that sensation. And this will vibrate back into the pineal, and your third eye will be open. The way to see things the best, and there will be things to see sometimes, is not to look for anything. Just let it be. Let it be. John Lennon was right about that. Let it be. Now the rest of my face. My face belongs to my ego and my personality. This is my face. No matter what my face looks like, always think of your face as a beautiful face, because it is. Now I go down to my chest and abdomen and pelvis area. Now I go up to my center of gravity, which is just above my navel somewhere. Can move back and forth a little bit and you'll find your center of gravity, and concentrate your attention there. Even though it's hard, there's not much to notice. Now from there, we expand our attention to our left leg and arm, to our right leg and arm, to our whole torso and head, and now the whole body. We have our attention on our whole body. So beautiful. There's so much you can do with this. After she passed on, Annie told me she could see me when I was like this. And the visitor said it causes a glow. And this other reality, this other level of reality can see the glow. Can see the glow. So you glow with me. I'll see you soon again on Dreamland. And thank you so much for being subscribers to Unknown Country. Do tell your friends and family about it, because we don't have many of you and we need more. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.